in the theme of this event is technology and innovation in healthcare. And actually, I just realized that Ilan has the perfect position that fits to the in terms of fitting to the today's theme, because he's a health innovation fellow at the institute working with Sasha. He graduated in 2011, and he went on and did his residency in family medicine at St. Michael's, and now he's in Toronto. I worked with him with his MBA, and he's a very interesting guy. When he asked us whether you know, his MBA internship, the current director of MD-MBA asked me to plug in the word internship somewhere in my speech, so I was looking for a way to do it, and I'm just going to use you for that. So when he said he wanted to do his MD-MBA internship in India, our first reaction was like, no, that cannot be done. And then the second reaction was, wait, if this can be done, Ilan is the guy who could do it. And he did a fantastic first international MD-MBA internship that set a precedence. In relaxing our constraints in terms of sending our students abroad, that they're going to come back in one piece. So, you know.
Well, you know who I am now. So, basically, what I'm going to talk about today is some of the guiding principles behind the work that we're doing at Weave, and in particular, the work that I'm involved in. And it's incubating and designing, and we're trying to achieve impact, and you've heard about what Sasha explained. So I'm going to talk about the promise, the need for it right now, the process that we're trying to really develop, because there's a lot of adaptation to the healthcare context, and some of the challenges that we're facing. So we're going to talk about some of the trends. We're going to talk about incubation, where we're borrowing this idea from. We're going to talk about how we're using design thinking, particularly with some of the projects that we're working with now, and then how and the can. So, look, people spoke about cost, so I don't need to drive the point too much, but here it is from another angle, which is basically how much of the provincial budget is going to healthcare. So, as you can see, it's 42 cents just a couple of years ago, and then it's going to go up to 70% within 12 years, which is really a lot. And, you know, we're talking about healthcare, so it sounds like it's really growing in healthcare, but think about education, think about, you know, transportation infrastructure. Their share of healthcare spend, the provincial budget is going to decrease a lot if these numbers hold true. And I just think as a society that just doesn't work. And I think we understand that. So faced with this kind of challenge, what kind of changes do we need? Is it small, incremental kind of change, or is it something a lot more fundamental? And I think it should be clear by the end that I'm advocating for the latter. So what's another thing happening in healthcare as we look at the landscape? I think this was made very clear by the story about Jill that Sasha explained, but there's a lot of complexity. And the three lines that I have over there could probably run for the whole slide, but there's a lot of pieces that are sometimes moving and sometimes very much in the way. And the question is, who's really dealing with the burden and the hardship of coordinating all this? And sometimes it's a family physician who's away in Florida or is a solo doc and has 100 people coming into their office. And I should say that I actually did cover for one of these docs when they're on vacation, and it is really chaotic. Is it the patient and their caregivers when they're at a vulnerable stage in their health trajectory? There's a lot of technology solutions that are put out there, but I really think it's inefficiency and increased costs and poor patient outcomes, which is where we see this translated to. Now, the third thing that I see when I look at this is that I'm in the world where there is generally very good service, and people are trying to provide very good service, whether I'm buying contact lenses online or some of the cases that we learned about during the MBA curriculum around the Ritz-Carlton service, which unfortunately I've yet to stay there and experience it, but one day. That's my dentist, where I go and see him and he sends an email saying, how was your experience? What was the wait time like? Was the front desk staff friendly? And they're absolutely amazing. I don't even know why he's asking me, but the fact that he cares about that already is kind of a place in my mind about that. And there's also this idea of rate MDs, which some of the docs in the room might have a particular opinion about that. But I think we're in a lot of marketplaces where people are trying to win us over through good service. And I just don't think that's happening so much in healthcare. People wait in a walk-in clinic for 2 hours, and it doesn't really bother them that much. They kind of expect that that's happening. It's kind of unacceptable to me. Record keeping total shambles. I'm trying to operate as a family doctor. I don't have discharge summaries. I got old discharge summaries that come 3 months later, but I've seen the patient already, and the context has now changed. And I think as a patient, you're often just disempowered. Sure, we're going to send you for this test. Take this form to the front desk. We're going to fax it. Wait to hear something. It's been 2 weeks. They come back. What can I do about it? There's really, really leave them in a vulnerable position. And I think as we look at other sectors, it's totally unacceptable, but we just take it as the way things are in healthcare. And hopefully that is changing. And I think if Western medicine is going to become, is going to stay relevant and stay respected as it is in society now, we're going to have to take this seriously. So with this, there are three needs for healthcare. So the first is that there's an urgency to get this right. And this is in the short and the long term. So we've got to do this now because the budgets are increasing, but we're going to have healthcare for forever. And how are we going to manage this in the long term? I think because of this, there's a real hunger that we have for novelty to achieve aims. And this is what I mean by the transformative kind of solutions. And I guess the last piece and the most important one, which gets me into the talk for today, is that the current improvement infrastructures that we have are really inadequate for the magnitude of change needed. And I think the Weave model is a great first step in that direction. And I'm glad to hear those sentiments echoed at the Jewish. So three needs for healthcare. You can easily change the slide and talk about startups. And this is where we take our inspiration from. So in terms of the urgency to get this right, you can imagine if you're investing in a company, you want it to give you some returns, both in the short term, so you're not sinking more into it, and then in the long term, so it becomes a worthwhile investment. There's a need for novelty, and we've heard all about disruption over the last few years and finding a true competitive advantage. And then with a lot of startups failing and the percentages being well over the majority, the failure risks were too high for investment, and there's some need for a mechanism to mitigate those risks. And that's where incubators come from. And I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with this, but just to review quickly, the idea is that you're supporting ideas and teams at their earliest and most vulnerable stage. And there's a few ways to do that. So you can accelerate learning and validation by putting them in the right kind of environment in front of customers. Then you should have a structure where they're able to harness that learning into real improvements into their product and service. And more from the side providing the incubation or providing the investment, you want to be able to soften the failure. So before you sink a ton of money into it, you invest a lot of time, you can kind of learn some things that signal you should be going in a different direction. Now, just structurally, the way these things are run, when you talk to people that go through incubators, they say the mentorship structure was the key thing. Being able to be around other startups or at similar stages was a key learning experience. And being able to share resources would otherwise be very hard for them to access, in particular things like legal or marketing. So if we can engage with more ideas at the early stage, perhaps we can get them into more viable kind of form where they could be implemented and scaled up. So what are some examples? So Rock Health is the big one within health, and I'm sure some of you may be familiar with them. There's Techstars and Y Combinator, and these are really the ones at the top of the heap in terms of getting funding for their alumni. Some of their alumni include Dropbox and Airbnb, and there's Omada, which is with Rock Health now. But it's not just the tech world that's embracing this. A lot of very well-known clinical entities are doing this. So in particular, Mayo, UCLA Health, and the Brigham Women's Innovation Hub. And I mention these three because we're actually going to be doing a panel with them at South by Southwest. South by Southwest is not a place where doctors generally go, but they are starting to go. And having been there last year, there's a real robust conversation around innovation and how to move things forward for patients in a very real way. So there is some caution with this. There's a lot of incubators out there. And in one article that I read, there's over 7,000. And the truth is that not all of them are successful. There's a lot of pretenders. They call themselves an incubator, and there they are. They don't really do very much beyond calling themselves that. If you look at some of the literature on successful incubators and not successful ones, it seems that really mentorship and having a structured development process is something that cannot be compromised on. Another issue with the whole incubator model is that how do you measure success? So a lot of the times when you talk about this is a successful incubator, this is a really good one, you should go and apply there, it's really because the follow-on financing is there, and that's a real reputational thing. So that's going to be a bit of a problem when we're trying to deal with health impacts and how do we measure that and value. There's the analogy doesn't really hold so well. Additionally, when you have a really successful incubator, that's where people want to go. And in some way, that success is sustained because of their excellent deal flow. And that's going to be a challenge that we're going to have in health as we adapt this. Where are we going to get our deal flow from? And what are the next steps? So after you graduate from an incubator, go in front of an audience at demo day, you might get money, you might not. What happens next? I think in healthcare, if we're going to put time and effort into an experience, we should be able to harness something out of it instead of just a demo day kind of moment. So I'd like to just turn to an article that was in the Stanford Social Innovation Review. And this came out last spring, but they talk about the art of funding innovation, obviously in social sectors. They talk about their five steps, and talk about sourcing, selecting, supporting, measuring, and scaling. And I think this incubation idea, obviously it's really good for supporting, but you can kind of move it upstream a little bit more into selection and sourcing, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But I think if this is something that you work with, this is a really important article to take a look at. So I'd like to segue to design thinking, which is the second sort of pillar concept that we're working with. And what design thinking is, it's, again, a response to some real pressures that's being dealt with in the startup world. And what it is, it's a realization that a thing or service is only as good as it understands its users and their needs. There are some techniques around this. It's not just something that you say to yourself when you get up in the morning. But it's a radically empathetic approach, which oddly enough is something we don't do enough in healthcare. And you map the drivers of behavior, because healthcare spending is a function of behavior. Healthcare outcomes are a function of behavior, both on the patient side and the practitioner side. And there are some real hard techniques which we're employing and adapting for healthcare context over at Weave that generate ideas, solutions, and ways to test them appropriately. What I like about it is that it's fun, different, and loose. So it really doesn't look like usual doctor work. So I don't know if it's still in the MBA curriculum, but there was a case that we discussed about IDEO, and it showed this Dateline segment about their shopping cart. And it was interesting to see how they approached this, but they were asked to redesign the shopping cart. They look at the way that people use the shopping cart, what their kind of pain points are with it, what are some of the issues that even the stores are having with shopping carts, and they came out with a new design. Now the truth is this design has zero uptake. It sort of went to Dateline and that was it. I don't quite understand why. But just to show you some of the features, they realize that people leave their cart in a particular area and go and get things from fruits and then bring it back, and then they go to the cereal section and so on and so forth. So they made this modular where you just pick up a basket, you can carry it around, get the things you need, and bring it back to your cart. They also they realized that theft was a big problem, and it's really hard to use a cart where you need the baskets for it. So that's one way that they addressed it. It's also lightweight, it's less expensive because you don't need all of the metal for the basket. And there was a real safety concern around putting kids in the shopping cart, and so they tried to improve the stability. So there's some needs, some pain points, and this is meant to address it. And the way that they do it, there's a lot of colorful sticky notes that are out there, and actually our meetings are like this, and it's 3 hours, but they pass very, very quickly, and often end too soon. So what's an example of this? So is anyone familiar with what this is, just by looking at it quickly? Is it clear? It's buried in there somewhere. But these are CRP results. So this is something that you look at when you're assessing someone's cardiac risk, although that's kind of phased out a lot now. Does this look user-friendly to anybody? No, nobody likes it. Good. All right. I get things like this all the time, and I'm sure many of us do. But I don't quite understand why, because it's so obviously bad. Who's like a clinician who might have used this recently? Okay, sure, Sasha, so I'll use you. So when's the last time you had to use something like this in a clinical context? And who were you talking to? And why were you even using this thing? What were you trying to achieve by engaging with this document?
Well, just they had a question. What to do with this? It was fairly obvious. What to do with this
result. Okay.
Yeah.
And was there some advice being generated out of this?
Yeah, that was the whole idea. Like they wanted to know that.
Okay, so that's a use case with a family doc. And what about with the patient? Do you ever go over these with patients?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, and oftentimes, because the patient has document information, and then they they Google it, they try to figure out what they go to the absolute worst thing that could possibly happen, and they bring in a stack of papers.
Okay.
So like, what do I do with that?
Generally, after you talk to a patient, like, imagine you're trying to get them to change some lifestyle things or diet, and does this help you do that?
This doesn't.
Okay, so still, all the labs are using something like this, and this is a font that really, outside of healthcare, you haven't seen it since the 80s or 90s. So there's some questions to consider, and the first is who uses this. And when I thought about this, I certainly didn't think about family doc and a cardiologist talking, but this is another use case, and it's important to ask these questions because you get things like that. So when you think of who uses this, I think of patients, I think of them taking it to their family members, I think of them comparing it to previous results. What do they do with it? Often they're asking me, what can I change? I have bacon 3-4 times a week, I don't exercise, but what do I need to do? What are the priorities here? Should I quit smoking? Should I not? Is the blood pressure important? I think as to what their needs are is that they need some type of, maybe this is being presumptuous, but they need some type of action that's going to come out of getting this information, or perhaps some reassurance, or some way to compare to how they've done, to say, look, I've done better, or I've done worse, and I need to make changes or not. I think some things that we're assuming is that they're going to understand a lot of the acronyms, that they're going to be able to keep it in that drawer and compare it in future time, that they're going to be able to show it to somebody else, and they're going to be able to understand it, that they speak English, because a lot of patients don't, especially in urban areas like Toronto and Montreal. And if we think of some ideas that would make this better, it's really not that hard. If we're already thinking we want them to change some of their lifestyle things, perhaps there should be some suggestions embedded in the results. Perhaps there should be some links, because why are we giving paper still? It should probably be online, to some videos or some resources or things like MyFitnessPal. And what about colors? Anyone want colors on this? So there's a bit more content there. So Wired actually put out a call for design firms to redesign cardiology blood work. And this was the winner. Its information is beautiful. They give a wonderful TED Talk about graphic representation of information, and actually have a coffee table book about it in case you're thinking of Christmas presents for any graphics nerds. But if you look at this, it's already kind of more engaging. There's colors. The colors seem to have meaning. There's some visual analog skill as well in terms of categories. And this one is much more patient-focused, as you can see the way they're talking about it. But they talk about your risk if you change certain factors, and what you can do now. Now, this is probably not very detailed information, but you could see that if you have a process whereby you put this in front of patients, you see how they react to it, you see what works, what doesn't, and you're able to get feedback and make changes, you can have a much more useful document than this, which is been the same for 20 years, and we just accept as something that should be, though it really shouldn't. So how are we using this, aside from just showing the work of other people? So Sasha referenced Scope. This is a program that, as he said, is like a spine for family docs that are solo family docs that have a lot of patients. Their patients are very complicated, and their patients, furthermore, are identified as using the emergency room more than other practices. And so initially, there was a whole suite of services that were put around the family doc, and realized that we're probably not getting the results that we're expecting to achieve in terms of driving down ER use. So one of the things that we did is that we said we really need to understand our patients a little bit better. And we have an anthropologist who's on our team. She's one of the research assistants. And her, as well as a couple of other people, went through, basically sat in the eMERGE, met with patients, interviewed them to see what their story was, what brought them in, why they did this, why they did that, why they didn't call their family doc, or why they did, what happened, how they felt. And we're able to get probably, I think it was about 20, 30 interviews from probably 4 or 5 pages of transcripts up to about 10. And we went through this whole design process. It took a few hours. We were able to cluster their needs, and we came up with an archetype map. The idea about the archetype map is that you're able to have patient types in a kind of grouping, and a patient is not necessarily in one strict way. They can obviously change as things go with them, but there's some cluster of needs, and you say, if I have a service, is a service really addressing these needs? So there are 4 clusters that we looked at, and I'm just going to show you 2, but as you can see, there are two axes. So one is more sporadic events, things come unpredictably. One is more chronic events. It's not quite the right term, and we're going to wrestle with that a little bit. But things that that you sort of expect to happen, like a flare of Crohn's, a flare of MS, or here's that abdominal pain I've been dealing with for 2 years. I don't have a diagnosis yet. I think it's happening again. I'm going to the emergency room. It's a bit of a different flavor than what's over on the left side. And then there's also a difference in terms of whether people need more social navigational support, or if what they really need is technical medical support that's probably a lot more predictable as to what they need, because there are things like guidelines and prior experience to help us. So just if we kind of contrast two of the archetypes, let's look at the archetypes of diagnostic uncertainty. I mean, you can read this for yourself, but I think the most important part is the user need aspect. As well as the pain points. I guess that would be second. So patients with diagnostic uncertainty, I'm talking about people who have non-specific symptoms or not yet diagnosed symptoms, things like dizziness, things like abdominal pain, things like chronic headaches, things of that nature. And then you can compare them to patients that have severe relapsing conditions. So this is like the Crohn's MS example that I gave you. And if you look at their needs and pain points, they're a different type of patient than the other group. And if we're going to have a suite of services and just say, here they are, go forth, both to the family doc and to the patient, it's probably not going to be the best. We have to tailor the messaging to these different groups and make sure that we're not sort of leaving one group just out on their own, such that we're not achieving what we're trying to achieve for them. So we found this to be a really useful exercise in terms of understanding the problem space that we're dealing with, and we're integrating this now into the communications and some of the ways that we're trying to get feedback as to whether these things are working or not. So just to highlight again some of the power of design thinking, it's the fruit is very low hanging, and so here are four anecdotes of what I call oops moments, where you put money and resources and time and people's efforts into building some sort of service to improve healthcare, and there's just some ridiculous flaw that takes 2 minutes to see that it's there, and it's totally overlooked. And with a bit of design thinking, you can avoid that. So in one case, it was a clinic for unilingual elderly. So this was particularly for Portuguese-speaking people, which, if you know Toronto, they generally cluster, ironically, around Little Italy. But a clinic was built at a downtown hospital, and they just don't take the streetcar there. That doesn't work. It was not very fruitful to put the clinic there at all, especially because there's another hospital right where they live. Another issue, they have a clinic, and they realized that it was a huge problem because of public transit. It's a big issue at Sunnybrook Hospital. You have to take a subway and then a bus, and then parking as well is another issue for patients, which you don't think about when you're designing a clinic, but this is part of the reality. This is something that I saw working as part of this novel service. That's a whole new concept around virtual care, but going and doing some of the home visits with the patients, they don't understand what it is. They're like, I don't know who I spoke to in the hospital, I'm enrolled with them, and now you're here now, and what's the social worker telling me about these services? It was just confusing. Like, I don't need this, it's fine. But the truth is they probably did, just the messaging was a problem. And you can sort of see that early on after talking to 3 or 4 patients. And then there's another you know, issue which probably happens a lot, although I don't have so much experience, but pretty early on in my career, but there's a lot of anecdotal need. We need this, we need that, we need that. You build a program that seems to respond to it, and the enrollment's not quite there. And you have to wonder, what are the needs really, and are we understanding them properly? And that's where these techniques help a lot. So going back to these 5 steps, to grow innovation in healthcare, what are the ways that we can do this? So now we're putting the puppies to work. So number one is with sourcing. So as you see in this diagram, there's clinicians, there's patients, there's startups as well in the community, which we have quite a few of in Toronto. And a lot of these entities are able to generate ideas. And we want ideas from many places, because the ideas that we have after generally clinicians providing them for decades and decades are obviously not sustainable, or not enough to have a sustainable system. So one thing is that I think having a solution-first approach is wrong. And does anyone know who that man is on the bottom? Exactly. So he's based out of Montreal. He's the Hacking Health guy. And we have a pretty nice relationship with them in terms of checking in every few months and helping some projects that have gone through their weekends. But one of the things that they notice is that when people come to Hacking Health and say, this is a problem that we have, this is a solution that I have, let's build something up in 48 hours, they're not getting big things, like capital B, big transformative things for particular patients, or reaching good, meaningful impact. So what they're trying to do is have longer engagements to spend more time talking about the problem and getting stakeholders involved who are able to make changes so that good impact will come out of this. And this is them sort of playing with their model, and we're going to see how this goes in the next few months. But this is, I think, an organization to get to know if you're interested in this space. The next has to do with selection. So a lot of the times, at least how this works in Ontario, is that the ministry says, these are our goals, come and achieve them. Reduce ER visits, reduce readmissions. And that's fine, but someone needs to sit and think, do these cause any externalities? So there was a paper that came out somewhere in the States, forget where, couldn't find it, so it's not here. But they were asked to reduce ER visits, and they found that actually for some patients, particularly complex ones, the overall costs, if you reduce the ER visits, go up because the admissions become more complicated and more lengthy. So, again, how generalizable is that outside of just their center? But it sort of asks the question as to whether these targets are as intelligent as we want them to be. And if you do have targets that are set up, are they targets that that really promote big thinking? So, so you can think about a family practice that wants to change its or reduce its budget by, let's say, 10%. They make a couple of changes. They rework some workflows. That's fine. But what about telling them, you know what, run it now on 50% of your budget? Now you really have to think about ideas and start from the ground up and change your foundation. And I think there should be some space to consider questions like that. And part of having this incubation approach is that you have a place for those ideas to develop. So what we do as an incubator is we're working with teams, giving them a lot of feedback. It's new ideas, new concepts. There's a lot of humility that has to come with it on all sides. And it's something that we're figuring out about ourselves, but also the teams that we're working with, really flexible, open to change. And one of the things that we encounter a lot is that they're very much stuck on their solution. No, it should look like this because this is what the literature says. And that's fine, but there's some more information out there than just the literature. It doesn't just have to be the solution. You're dealing with a problem, not a solution. So that's kind of a bit of a cultural shift that I think is very very important when engaging with teams. So then there's a supporting aspect, and this is really where the incubation comes in. So what does this look like in health? So the number one thing is clinical validation. Everyone can have an idea, everyone can show it to their friend and get a thumbs up, but you need clinical champions to put this in front of patients. If you have pilots, they should be with real people, not just from the patient side, but also fitting into the workflows, because if it doesn't fit with the workflows, if it bothers, you know, what anyone from the receptionist to the chief of the department, it's not going to work. The other thing, too, is that you need to have some mechanism where you're going to learn something, put it back into your product or service very quickly, and get it right back out there into the world. And just to contrast what it's like in a hospital environment to what it's like outside, a friend of mine is actually the designer for Interaction, and they, a couple of months ago, put out this brain-sensing headband that's meant to actually promote mindfulness and relaxation. And I've never used it, but on Amazon, the reviews are something like 4.5 stars, which is great, because I don't know you know, how much work went into that, but they've definitely achieved having a good product, and they did very well at a lot of the electronic shows, the big one in Vegas, I forget what it's called, but they stole a show there. So as a designer, he actually has someone who's hired part-time to bring him in, a full-time recruiter, to bring him in six potential users every Wednesday. And what he does is that he has some question ready to test in front of these people. And he's like, whether or not I really have a question, I have to come up with something that I want to learn about our product, about our service, about the whole ecosystem around this headband. And I'm going to put it in front of six people, I'm going to watch them, and I'm going to get something out of it and discuss it with my team. And every week I have some iteration of the service, whether it's the hardware itself, the way people are meant to use it, whether it's the app or their website or the disclaimers or whatever it is. And just that commitment to learning from putting it in front of real people, I think is something really refreshing if it's to happen in healthcare. So that's what's happening in the startup world. That's how they're they're making a company that's going to make money, and if we want to have a hospital, it's going to have good impacts. I think we have to take a similar approach. Get it in front of people and learn. Now, when it comes to supporting, it's not just a question of having a doc who has experience. There's a lot of pieces to it, as you could see. And I think in particular, the new thing is to have the designer on there. Designers have a lot of experience working with different problems, different teams, and a lot of the challenges that they've overcome, and I think it's helpful to have someone with a different set of eyes that comes from a different place giving some advice. And we've worked with probably 3 designers now, different quality, but when they're excellent, just the thing soars, and it's a great experience. So what about measurement? So often we think about putting something into a randomized controlled trial and maybe do a quick pilot before, and that's fine. But there's one project that we're working with, which is actually it's a step-down unit for psychiatric patients. So they're admitted to CAMH, which is the Douglas equivalent in Toronto, and they have a very high readmission rate, actually higher than the national average, which is not good for the flagship mental health institution of the city. And so they came up with this program, which based generally on the literature and experience of previous of other sites, that's going to help these patients transition back to their community. So part of it is giving the patient a place to go. Part of it is supporting their community physicians, which are generally the family doc who doesn't have a discharge summary, has no idea the patient was even there. So you can imagine these are easy things to correct. But they wanted to go to a pilot. And we said, you know what, hold on for a second. Let's just do a little bit of anthropological work. And so really what we told them, and it took a few meetings, is just let us follow 5 patients first. And so we're doing this now. And even just from those 5 patients, you're able to learn a lot. And it's things that are kind of obvious once you see it, but beforehand they really were not obvious. So a lot of it had to do with their intake process, where, sure, for the study you need to have all these forms, all these validated questionnaires, but it really wasn't patient-friendly, wasn't helping the program, wasn't giving them more information, so they significantly pared it down. And I think that really probably took about 1.5 patients for that to come about. You notice some personnel that it's just not going to work. You don't want to go to 30-person pilot with this particular person. You could see that after 2 or 3 people that they're not the right person for the job in terms of the skill sets that they have. We look at some of the service gaps. So some of the things that we thought would be okay, oh, we can be able to hand them off to XYZ, it's actually not quite there. It's not quite readily available as we think, and we need to rethink our service because of that. And basically, by listening to patients and what their experience is, you can kind of see there's some things in the program that don't make sense and need to change, and we're really happy that we know about them now, as opposed to once we've committed to some sort of study design, and then you kind of really look foolish. And the last piece really has to do with scaling. So I'm going to show you on the next slide how we fit with Weave structure, but you think of how they are in startups. It's obviously not the same in terms of a health context. But in a health context, a lot of the ideas come from what I call use case innovation. So basically, there's a particular person running a clinic. They have a problem. They come up with a solution for their problem, which is not necessarily the same one that other people are having. So it's not scalable just from the outset because it's so unique to their situation. So I think when we're coming up with solutions, we need to think about scale from the outset. This is something that we're trying to do in our work, and that has to do with capacity, with funding, the political will at different places, as well as the barriers to uptake. So this is our work. Basically, this is the incubator, which is supporting Beacon, which Sasha referenced, which is being hosted at Weave, and then Women's College houses all of this. And if there's more questions about that, probably Sasha can answer them. But we're supporting a lot of ideas that are coming both from the hospital, mostly from the hospital right now, some from outside institutions, and some will graduate to enter this big provincial national network of Beacon. So if we look at the work that we're doing, just to highlight some of the criteria for the projects that we're working on, as part of this Spore grant that Beacon's working on, there needs to be a clinician, researcher, and policy in leadership, and I think this really helps the dialogue around some of the projects that we're taking or not taking. It has to be trialed across 2 jurisdictions, so at the incubator we're not doing that, but we're getting things ready to do that. It has to address the needs of complex patients, that's really what the grant is for. And most importantly, there needs to be a capacity for rapid evaluation, monitoring, and feedback, and I think the incubator trying to use these techniques at Women's is really trying to achieve that. So the question is, can this work in healthcare? And we're finding out. So I'd like to take you through that based on the 5 steps. So let's turn into three, actually. We'll cluster sourcing and selection together. So there are definitely some problems. So the first is really that too many solutions have limited impact or cost containment, and they're not big enough considering the budgetary changes that we're facing. Scalability is an issue, and additionally, the teams that are taking these projects on, they're not designers, they're not business people, they're not all the kinds of things that you need to have a project work, which is probably more than whatever I had on that slide earlier. So the question is, are we solving the right problems, and is there a space to have that discussion? And I guess it all boils down to the last line there. How good is our deal flow? So how good are the ideas that are coming in? How transformative are they? How are the teams that are supporting them? And are they really addressing the right problems? And I think that's where a lot of work is going to be from Weave in the next few years in terms of improving this. And I think the work that we're doing in that, frankly, is quite promising. So again, for sourcing and selection, I mean, you see some of the things that we need to do, but I think in a nutshell, it's following what Hacking Help is learning, it's following what we're learning, it's that we need some space where the stakeholders who can pull the levers are talking about the problems that are there and that we're exploring them and continuing that discussion as opposed to just having it once and running with it and perhaps carrying some fatal flaws along the way. So what about support? So Sasha mentioned this in talking about the REV issues that we're having, but institutions in their nature, they don't have the agility to meaningfully support projects that need to move fast. They move fast in the outside world, they're going to have to move fast in health, but it's hard to get that done. And I think having this sort of research solution that we found at Women's is one step in the right direction. But that's not the only barrier. There are many barriers, and this is something that culturally is changing at the hospital. Many teams are obsessed with their solution, as I mentioned before, as opposed to the problem. And really what I think the big issue is that there's a lot of shortcuts that are taken. So clinicians, myself included, I'm guilty of this, we really don't like to get our hands dirty. So there's not a lot of face-to-face time because we work in clinics, we see when we can get a meeting, a lot of it's by email or by the phone, and that's not how an incubator works. The way an incubator works is that you're there in this room with all these other startups, 14, 16-hour days talking, interacting, getting coffee, shooting ideas, bouncing ideas off one another. And it doesn't look like that in a healthcare context, and I wonder what the compromise is, and I think we'll see. I also skip strange tasks. So just working with some of the projects that we're working on, we tell them, let's do a driver diagram, let's do this needs assessment, let's brainstorm around these ideas, and you get the post-its out. It's like, okay, it's weird, this is cute, can we just do this next time? The commitment to do it isn't quite there until they see the power of some of the techniques, and then they really start to buy into it. And that's definitely been the experience with the psychiatric project I mentioned. And there's also this kind of tendency to revert to expertise. It's like, well, we know this, so let's kind of stick to that. Okay, but dig into a little bit more, do some of these needs discovery exercises, and maybe we'll learn something else. And I think when you mix those techniques with the expertise, very good things can happen. So can an institution create a culture of true collaboration? I think it's a really hard thing to do, but it can definitely happen. And then there's this concept of equipoise, which is point number three, which is that if things don't work out, that's okay. We learned something. Let's pivot on to the next thing and keep it going, and none worse for it. A lot of the times it's not quite there. It's like this thing needs to work, and if the data doesn't support it, people get very nervous, which it really shouldn't be if you're doing design in its truest sense. So for this to work, it has to be a priority, and I think this echoes both Sachs' talk and Dr. Rosenberg's talk. And if you have that kind of environment, very good things can happen. There should be very good mentorship, and it's not just at the clinical level, it's as well as other areas of expertise, and the hospital needs to recognize that in terms of bringing on designers, bringing on people who understand how to build something and scale something up. There really should be the time and space to carry momentum forward, and I think that's what the incubator tries to solve, and I think we are doing it. And the last piece really involves measurement and scale. And when you're in this early kind of phase in terms of the trajectory of the development of an idea, you're going to get a lot of feedback from just talking to people and getting their ideas and saying, hold on, that person said something similar, that person said something similar. There's no number behind that, but that's a very strong signal. And we need to sort of recognize that as something very valid and something worth pivoting on in terms of our solutions. And basically, can we learn from failure? And having a failure conference, I think, is a step in that direction. And so there you go. Another thing too, you need to integrate policymakers from the outset, I think, to understand why, how something can scale or not. And that's something that the beacon structure addresses. So can this work in healthcare? I think the answer is yes, but a lot of it comes down to culture. So a lot of the to do this we need to, a lot of it had to do with the mindset of being open to these relatively new ways of doing things in healthcare, both from design and from incubation, where things are moving quickly and intensely. And so cultural shift, and I was really happy to hear Dr. Rosenberg talking about that. So does anyone know who this is? No? Okay. So this is Dick Fosbury, and he was a high jumper. And high jumping, this is obviously an old picture, but in the 50s and 60s, there was this particular way you do it where I think you put one leg over and then swing the other leg over, and people could jump about 7 feet doing that. It was a bad I'm going to tear my pants. Yeah, with 1 foot on the ground, right? But he came up with this different technique where you now go over your back. And if you've ever watched the Olympics and you see the high jump, that's how people do it now. And this is a Fosbury flop, and he was able to achieve results that were 2 or 3 inches above what anyone is able to do, and it's totally changed the way things are done in high jumping. So I think in healthcare, it's a similar kind of idea. We're doing things now. We're coming up with a lot of pilot projects, and we have a way of coming up with ideas, and that's great. But if we're going to make a real leap, and I'm apologizing for the pun, we're going to have to come up with some new techniques, and I'm proposing these as techniques. With that, this might not be perfect. Maybe in 5 years, we're looking at these ideas that I'm talking about today, and like, this was not a very good fit, and we're onto this new thing. And that's great, but I think if we have the openness to say that there's some new way out there, and let's try and try and try and accept that what we have now is not okay, then that's perfect. And I think that that will stay and persist for much longer. So that is it. Any questions?
One is, I think one of the things that really struck me about your talk was the importance of embedding getting patient input, which in fact in healthcare we do on a very, very, very infrequent basis. So it's neat to see that you talked about using my anthropologist to help get that, but increasingly what's going on across the country is in fact a patient engagement movement. And patients are being, the expectations are changing inside healthcare organizations to embed them in the co-design work directly. And so asking their opinions when they're in an ER or waiting for a service or whatever is a really important strategy, the shadowing that you talked about. But we're trying to push it further, and that's to actually get them directly involved and present in all decision-making forms operationally. What struck me is you talked about the challenges. I work inside healthcare. Mm-hmm. Operationally, so I know it resonates. For me, one of the biggest challenges is actually physician input. So these quality improvement teams are, in fact, growing up all over the country, using many of the skills. A lot of people are getting comfortable with their driver diagrams, or doing the rapid cycle improvement processes. My experience so far is that physicians are present in very, very low dose or none. And I wonder if there's a fundamental flaw in the system about incentivizing physician involvement, which is so critical, around reimbursement. Like, how do you get a physician free for a day of really creative thinking and brainstorming, the IPO approach?
Yeah.
So have you come across any creative solutions in Toronto or elsewhere about the incentivization of physicians so that they can, in fact, join those teams that are growing up all over the country?
So for the projects that we're working on now, they're actually led by more than one physician. So for the psych project, for example, there's one physician lead and then two kind of more senior docs that are there in an advisory kind of role. But again, the low dose thing is an issue that we have more for the two senior ones. But like at the incubator, there's myself, there's two other family docs who are like myself, only about a year outside of residency, and an eMERGE doc as well, and our lead is a family doc. And so I think for now there's some input there, but you know, what's the sustainability of it? I don't know. But that's an issue, and I think part of what we're trying to do in the next few months is have some events to really get a lot of the wider physician community on board to want to be involved in projects because it's interesting. And if I like, I went to a Shark Tank event that was held at Brigham Women's Hospital in Boston, and asked them a similar thing: how do you get docs involved in this thing? And they're like, you know what, it's not for everybody, but probably about a third of the ones that we spoke to were like, great, you know what, my life is boring and I really want to be involved in this because it's new, something is moving, I can give input, and it's a fun thing. And and I think their experience of just reaching out has been pretty good, and that's what we're starting to do now in terms of some of the events that we're planning outside of the projects that we're directly working with.
Question about the selection and sort of the pipeline management. Also referring to the first talk, mm-hmm. I think, you know, both of you show these a great number of examples of sort of high potential projects and initiatives, and the approach seems to be mostly about sort of a distributed approach. So those who are involved in the system, they recognize it and where sort of the biggest problems lay, and they bring up the problems. And it seems to be very important. I think if you look at other organizational settings where cultural change, where change needs to happen, and we need that cultural shift, this bottom-up approach is very critical. At the same time, there seems to be a risk of sort of proliferation of ideas, given that there is this very limited capacity. Of course, you want to improve the capacity and involvement, but there's very limited capacity. So it seems that the emphasis on more projects is better as long as they're good, right? But it seems that even if you get a whole large number of good projects, there's a big risk of sort of a lagback because it's just you can't sustain that number of projects. So that's one difference with sort of other environments. The mm-hmm. other one is is there some way that you, besides the distributed, importance of the distributed starting of this project, can you aggregate the knowledge? So it's another way of thinking about scaling up. So both points relate to sort of the managing of the pipeline, and in that sense, more is not always better. And sort of how is that connect in these initiatives?
So I mean, you're right that more is not always better, and I think as what the incubator is trying to do is get a lot of these things when you just have a large number of ideas, you don't know where they're going to go, and you have an initial engagement with them just to get a few signals on the potential and then take it further. So it's a bit of a staged kind of thing. So one is just building out the model, validating it again with patient involvement, and then seeing if the teams themselves are able to learn something and change their model based on that. So that's something that should not take too much resources to do initially. And then if you get some good signals there, then you sort of come and surround the team a little bit more. But by staging things, we hope that we're not just throwing resources at too many things, and everything gets diluted, and it doesn't really go anywhere. And what was the second thing?
Well, it's both related actually to the management of the size and the mix of the pipeline,
right,
as a contrast to the need, obviously, to get sort of this distributed input. But so, you know, as you start up, it's probably not critical to have. To manage the numbers, being more is better in the beginning, but as it grows, you want to sort of manage that more because of this limited area.
And so part of what we're going to have to be developing over the next few months is a vetting process for the ideas. How do we know what is good? How do we know what team is good? And I think one of the ways that we're doing that, talking about the learning that you mentioned in your comments, is that we have a lead health fellow kind of coaching each team, as well as a second one on board. And every week when we have our meetings about the various activities that we're doing, there's a debrief as to what's going on in each project, and somebody brings forward a problem that they're having, and we all kind of give some input on that. The idea is that this is early, and if things are going on in one project, that somebody's learning about it, I should learn about it too, even if it's not my project. And this is something that as we grow, we're going to have to see how does this kind of model transition. It's a challenge. It's a challenge.
You're wonderful. Yeah.
I just want to make sure I give John sufficient time and we'll have more time to discuss. So, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.